Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today in episode 118, I'm joined by Dr. Adrian Scott of Wilmer Eye Institute at Johns Hopkins University. We discuss management of sickle cell retinopathy, as well as underrepresented minorities in ophthalmology. On a separate note, thank you to everyone who came out to our inaugural social media and online content for retinal specialist course at the American Society of Retinal Specialists meeting this past weekend. We do hope you enjoyed it. For those of you who did not get the chance to attend, we will be doing a similar course at the American Academy of Ophthalmology meeting this fall in Chicago, and I'll provide more details as we get closer. Is this Dr. Scott?
Hi, it is.
Hey, Jay Schreeder, how are you?
Hi, I'm great, Jay. How are you doing?
I'm good. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Adrian Scott. Dr. Scott is Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at Wilmer Eye Institute at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Scott, thank you for joining us.
It is my pleasure, Dr. Schreeder.
So we usually start episodes with new guests by discussing their background and why they chose to become an ophthalmologist and a retinal surgeon. And this is helpful for, I think it's generally interesting, but we do have some medical students, residents who like to listen, figure out how people got where they were. So was ophthalmology something you had decided on before you went to medical school?
No, not at all. Dr. Schreeder, ophthalmology is something I somewhat fell into. I actually started medical school thinking and planning to be a pediatrician, and that love of children and love of science. So one of my earlier rotations was the surgery rotation, and my best friend and I took this together because we thought it was the hardest, and we wanted to plan to be able to do it together. We thought if we did it earlier, people would be less likely to be angry at us if we made mistakes, didn't know what we were doing. But I ended up just loving surgery more than I ever thought that I would. So, I planned at that point to join one of the surgical subspecialties. The field of ophthalmology definitely appealed to me because it does combine a lot of aspects of medicine that I enjoy. You can have a diverse career even within ophthalmology. You can do a lot of surgery. You can do no surgery at all. You can treat people long-term for their lifetimes. You can, treat everybody from the front of the eye to the back of the eye. And people's vision is most important to them. I think being able to learn a field that was so important to many patients where you could really have an impact and have such a wide variety of potential even careers within ophthalmology was what was appealing to me.
Well, and then what about retina? When did you decide on that?
Yeah, so once I thought I was going to be an ophthalmologist and I loved pediatrics, then I said, well, goodness, well, there's a whole field if you could just see kids and I could be a pediatric ophthalmologist. So, I initially thought that that would be an interesting field, but then I realized that kids don't necessarily, like when you put drops in your eyes and in their eyes, and they're particularly difficult to examine. And so early on, I actually thought after pediatric ophthalmology didn't seem to be the field for me, I actually thought about glaucoma for quite a while. When I was down at Duke University for my residency, we have such a strong glaucoma department there, and our late departed beloved chairman, Dr. David Epstein, is a glaucoma specialist, and he, the faculty and the chairman there put a lot into teaching the residents. They really made glaucoma seem exciting, and they brought it to life. So it was just fortuitous. I ended up taking an extra extra few weeks on the retina rotation because of one of the other residents had some issues where they couldn't rotate. So I really filled in for this resident and was on the retina rotation almost for double my other rotations. And it just hooked me. It was something that was fascinating to me, and it was around the time when anti-VEGF treatment was starting to become prevalent. People were starting to really explore imaging with the advent of the spectral domain OCTs and use them quite widely. So I think once you started to be able to be around retina surgeons. They seem, in my opinion, to be the most dynamic, have the most innovative type of technologies, and we were really starting to impact patients' vision with their, you know, the anti-VEGF treatments. And, you know, I always thought that, you know, in ophthalmology, I said, you know, one of my mentors used to always say the retina specialists are like the Marines of the eye. So we have to know the eye from front to back, and it's one of these things where I always thought that, you know, if you can do retina, you really can do anything. So we thought it was the most challenging, but also really the most beautiful field to master. So retina and eye are kind of a circuitous route toward finding one another, but, you know, I really just fell in love with, you know, how dynamic and amazing a field it is and how much of a difference you can really make for patients.
And then, you know, one of the things you've been known to do a lot of research and working, you talked about is sickle cell retinopathy. And sickle cell is interesting because how much people see it, and we're going to have people listening to this podcast now from around the world, really varies geographically about where they're practicing. But it's challenging because it's unlike many other proliferative retinopathies when it does become proliferative. So can you tell us a little bit about why you first got interested in sickle cell? Was this related to kind of your pediatrics crossover? Let's talk just briefly about stages for those who may not be aware, and then how you approach treatment and when you decide to operate on these patients.
Sure. And, you know, sickle cell retinopathy research is one that I, you know, also just kind of fell into. So I am originally from Maryland, and my Hopkins has been my first and only faculty job thus far. And my husband and his family are from Baltimore. So, you know, Johns Hopkins and me being from Maryland and my husband being from Maryland, Johns Hopkins seemed a great fit. And I was also fortunate to join a large retina division and be mentored by one of the you know, premier retinal specialists who really taught us what we know about sickle cell retinopathy, Dr. Mort Goldberg. Dr. Goldberg, at the time when I joined the faculty, was starting to ramp down his practice and was, you know, sharing a lot of his patient load at the time, and I didn't have that much of a patient load, and so I took on a lot of his patients. And, you know, it's a fascinating disease, and I started to really see a lot of patients with the disease, and the more patients that I saw, and to this day, the more patients with sickle cell that we see, you know, I see, I feel like the more we don't know about the field. You mentioned quite astutely that it is a proliferative retinopathy, but it's really unlike others. So one of my key burning questions in research is, okay, so we have a diabetic. We tell a diabetic you need to control your blood sugar, blood pressure, and tight glycemic control can decrease your risk of worsening retinopathy or developing retinopathy. And in sickle, you have a similar issue with peripheral retinal ischemia, such as you can see in diabetes, the potential for neovascularization, but it just doesn't seem to follow a pattern that we can identify at present. The patients with the different genotypes, meaning hemoglobin SS disease versus those with hemoglobin SC disease, can present completely differently. And sickle cells also and retinopathy is a very interesting disease in the fact that these are patients that actually have great visual acuities, and oftentimes they're sent for screening, and you know the patient really won't have any symptoms at all, and will be, you know, wondering why they're even there in the retina clinic. But even with these great visual acuities, sickle patients can have quite extensive retinal non-perfusion and even neovascularization. So, you know, it's such a really, you know, interesting disease. Typically, the hemoglobin SC patients are called these variant hemoglobinopathy patients. They will tend to have more of a risk of retinopathy, and that means predominantly the peripheral retinopathy that can lead to neovascularization, potentially tractional elevation of the retina, traction detachment, vitreous hemorrhage, and those are the later stages of sickle cell retinopathy. And the patients with the homozygous disease, the SS patients, will typically have less likelihood to progress toward neovascularization, although there is about a 20% prevalence of neovascularization in SS patients. They will be less likely to have very severe peripheral disease in the retina. Although the odd part about it is they are many times more systemically sick, so more risks of more likelihoods of having strokes, more likelihoods of having issues with their things like avascular necrosis, pulmonary hypertension, and frequent pain crises, whereas mm-hmm. patients with SC disease have more of the retinopathy, but often are systemically feeling fine and rarely get pain crises.
So, and not to interrupt, but you've done so much work in research. Any reasons or thoughts into why that's the case?
Sure. There are some theories as to why the difference exists. And in general, the thought, and one of the thoughts that I have, is that when you have SC disease, hemoglobin SC, you have this level of chronic ischemia going on, and you have chronic release of these pro-angiogenic factors that can be pathologic when they get out of balance. And then you have the tip toward proliferative retinopathy. Whereas in hemoglobin SS disease, a lot of times what you'll see is vascular occlusion as opposed to this ischemia. So the vascular occlusion, can lead to, you can have retinal non-perfusion, but because it doesn't seem to be as VEGF driven, with the level of ischemia, there really doesn't appear to be the level of progression to the higher stages of neovascularization as in SC patients. But it's not completely understood, and patients can have different eye disease even from one eye to the other. So it's just something that, still a work in progress to really try to understand.
And then in terms of when you decide to intervene, how that relates to the different stages, when do you decide, for example, to do laser or to do vitrectomy on a patient?
Sure. So the typical dogma, and we compared it, we just mentioned kind of some of the contrasts between PDR, proliferative diabetic retinopathy, and proliferative sickle retinopathy. So typically, patients with sickle retinopathy will have pathology in the peripheral retina, as opposed to diabetics will have posterior pathology. And our teaching in PDR is that you do PRP usually when you have high-risk characteristics, meaning new neovascularization. Now, again, sickle is such a very unique disease, and the fact that many patients can have neovascularization in the form of these very notable appearing CFAN lesions, so these CFAN neovascular lesions, and the oftentimes they can even auto-infarct. So they can just shrink up, become less likely to bleed, and become less likely to enlarge and cause detached retina on their own. So just by observation, patients with CFAN neovascularization, and up to maybe 40% of the cases, can regress on their own. I treat when I do see a patient with active appearing CFAN neovascular lesions, and by that I mean kind of reddish, very defined vessels, as opposed to the whitish, fibrotic looking vascular complexes. If I see more of those progress over time, if I see a particular CFAN lesion enlarge or progressive traction on the retina, if the patient's had any sort of vitreous hemorrhage, because that shows me that lesion is actually large enough and it's bleeding and causing intermittent traction, perhaps in the back of the vitreous. And, certainly I would consider laser treatment if the person has had a bad outcome in the other eye, had sickle-related or, for whatever reason, loss of vision in the other eye, I'd be more prone to treat with laser treatment. Vitrectomy treatment I reserve for patients with non-clearing vitreous hemorrhage or patients, obviously, with traction or combined traction and regmatogenous retinal detachment. I have found that the CFAN neovascular lesions actually do respond in a nice way to anti-VEGF therapy, and I have used it in select cases as well. So I'm still exploring, the use of anti-VEGF as it relates to sickle cell retinopathy.
And then in terms of, let's say, once you decide whether it's for vitreous hemorrhage or retinal detachment to take a patient to surgery, what sort of special surgical considerations do you keep in mind? So if you were, for example, staffing a fellow, what sort of things would you bring up preoperatively to anticipate intraoperatively that would be important, that would differ from a diabetic case?
That's a great question, Dr. Sridhar. So you need to have good communication with the patient hematologist in the hematology team. I'm fortunate to be in an institution that has a very a strong hematology department, and oftentimes the patients will have a hematologist involved in their care. So I would communicate the need for surgery with the hematologist, and in advance of surgery, they might suggest exchange transfusion to try to maximize the patient's, you know, oxygenation, less risk of developing, pain crises after surgery. I would definitely communicate with the anesthesiologist to maximize oxygenation during surgery. And in as far as the vitrectomy itself, one of the old dogmas was that you can't put a scleral buckle on a patient with proliferative sickle retinopathy because of the risk of causing anterior segment ischemia. And while that is a reasonable concern, I've used buckles before, scleral buckles when indicated. So if there are peripheral breaks, I would put on a scleral buckle, you know, if I thought it were indicated. But care has to be taken to maybe use a thinner buckle and be cautious about, you know, how much, you know, how tight that you actually have the buckle in these eyes. You need to pay meticulous attention to what is the intraocular pressure during the surgery itself. So sickle patients usually wouldn't tolerate a very high eye pressure for long periods of time, so it's important to minimize bleeding. I have used anti-VEGF preoperatively in proliferative sickle cases, and it's worked beautifully to try to make the CFAN neovascular complexes easier to dissect and also to decrease our risk of intraoperative bleeding. We also have advocated for doing these types of cases under general anesthesia. I think patients with sickle cell in general, most of my other vitreoretinal surgery cases are done under, peribulbar subtenons, particularly, or retrobulbar block. So with sickle cell, I have done cases with subtenons. However, I find these eyes very difficult to anesthetize, and it's very difficult to get the patient comfortable. And the more pain they have, the more likely they are, is kind of a cycle that feeds into causing the systemic pain crises. And, you know, that's something that's not favorable for the patient's outcome. So, meticulous attention to oxygenation, hydration, and pain control. And I typically would advocate for general anesthesia in these cases.
And then let's say you're doing a detachment. How meticulous is your vitreous shave compared to other cases? Does your tamponade be changed at all because they have sickle cell, or is it simply, again, dependent on the pathology you see like it would in a regular retinal detachment? And obviously the status of the eye would come into it, as you mentioned earlier, but anything different that you think of in these cases? Are you more concerned about redetachment in these patients?
Sure. So luckily, when we get patients with sickle cell retinopathy, luckily these cases that go on to traction detachments are rare, but I do find that they're particularly challenging and unforgiving in the fact that at any time, and most of us have seen what pictures look like of patients with sickle retinopathy and the degree of peripheral non-perfusion that there is that we can note on wide-field fluorescein angiography. That translates to retina that's very thin and prone to iatrogenic breaks. So when you are doing vitrectomy and trying to dissect the neovascular complexes, as I mentioned, I would give an anti-VEGF ahead of surgery to try to decrease the risk of bleeding and facilitate the dissection. And there have been some other authors who advocate for more segmentation, which is, decreasing the anterior posterior traction, segmenting the fibrovascular complexes from the anterior to posterior vector forus, as opposed to delamination, which is removing tangential traction, actually pulling, dissecting the CFAN neovascular complexes from the peripheral retina, because these cases, the retina is very friable and it will break and tear very easily. So you have to be extra cautious. Again, diabetics, the pathology is a little bit more posterior most times, and then you have a little bit stronger retina that may not break or tear as easily, but sickle retinas do tear very easily. As far as tamponade goes, if I need to use gas, I'll use gas. If I need to use oil, I'll use oil. Like you said, it kind of really depends on the you know, the status in the other eye. If they have lost vision in the other eye, I'll tend to go toward using oil in these patients. I do like to stay away from oil if at all possible, if only to save them an additional surgery. The surgery itself can, you know, put the patient through quite a bit of systemic stress and pain. And if I can get by with only doing the one surgery with gas tamponade, that would be my preference.
And my final question, you know, sickle cell is such an interesting topic. And again, you see a lot, we mentioned earlier, the geographic variability. And some people are people in the world who've never seen sickle cell retinopathy. And if you live in an area where there is a lot of sickle cell disease or SC disease, you'll see extensive sickle cell retinopathy. What about the family or genetics? You know, how much does that factor into your practice? You mentioned, you know, we know sickle cell is a genetic disease. Is this something that if, let's say you have a patient who has proliferative sickle retinopathy, how often are you screening their children, for example, if they have sickle trait or SS or SC? What sort of practice do you maintain for those patients either who have minimal disease or have not manifested if they're very young?
Yes. So my kind of theory with sickle, and, you know, one of these things I'm doing, you know, the research to try to provide data for, is that if you look for pathology in patients with sickle, you will find it. So even patients as young as 4 or 5, we've done OCT angiography and seen flow loss in the layers of the retinal capillary plexus. plexi, to be able to, you know, that it's attributable likely to sickle cell. So if you look for, if you image a sickle patient, you likely will see some type of vascular compromise. Certainly if you do, you know, the wide field imaging as well, you can see peripheral vascular dropout. Now, the guidelines to screen sickle patients are drawn, you know, they also come about by expert consensus. There are no real large scale clinical trials for sickle retinopathy that says, you know, how to screen. So expert consensus recommendations are that patients should be screened annually starting at age of 10 with sickle cell disease. You know, I typically won't follow up. I won't necessarily, if somebody has trait, I typically won't treat them any different than just normal standard of care, just a good dilated eye exam annually. But interestingly enough, a lot of patients with sickle and, you know, sickle cell disease, that's the follow-up. We can see proliferative retinopathy. Like I mentioned, it might actually infarct on its own. If they have proliferative retinopathy, I usually see them about every 6 months. If they have no proliferative retinopathy and I see non-perfusion, or I see maybe some things like salmon patches or black sunburst spots, or, you know, these typical marks of non-proliferative sickle, then I'll see them yearly too. So, you know, even though we're seeing pathology, we kind of note that it doesn't necessarily change management or even oftentimes the follow-up schedule in non-proliferative sickle cell retinopathy. Proliferative disease, I would watch them a little bit more closely to make sure that they're not progressing.
Yeah, switching gears, and I'm going to cite a publication that you were the senior author on. This was published, as I make sure I have it up, in Ophthalmology in March 2018. It was entitled Evaluation of Medical Students' Perception of an Ophthalmology Career. And this was a brief article kind of just discussing the different factors that go into why medical students decide to do ophthalmology and what sort of demographics we're seeing. And one of the things that were noted was that underrepresented minorities were less likely to choose to go into ophthalmology. And many of them said it was because they felt like they're just insufficient mentors of the same background, or they felt they maybe couldn't find a mentor of the same ethnic or gender background. You want to talk a little bit about this paper? It's a very, very interesting paper, and what you found when doing it, and what you think it means for the future, and what we need to do as a field to kind of encourage maybe a more democratic availability of the field to everyone.
Well, you know, that article was fascinating to me. I mean, to be able to do the research and see what students thought. There is going to be a shortage of ophthalmologists as people are living longer. These chronic diseases, such as age-related macular degeneration, even patients with diabetes, the prevalence of these diseases causing blindness is only going to increase as the years go on. So we need more ophthalmologists, and I want this to be a career. I think it's an amazing career. I want it to be a career that everyone would think of who's in medical school. And because I think it's such a, so many vast choices to make such a difference in people's lives. So, I think that one of the things I've learned from that research is that getting students engaged and interested in ophthalmology early on in their medical school careers is key. Sometimes it's not something that students even think of, and that's why we did the paper. We said, well, why is that? Why wouldn't you even think of ophthalmology? And I think some people think it is one of the reasons that we found, insufficient interest, or they just didn't really know enough about it. So what we can do is to try to go out of our way to mentor students and take them under our wings. A lot of the ophthalmology curricula has been moved to later in medical school learning, and I think that's been a mistake, and students don't get a chance to see how wonderful a career ophthalmology is until maybe they've decided to go into another specialty. So, I think earlier exposure for all groups, women, men, and all comers, I think underrepresented minorities and non-minorities, I think that's key for drawing people into the field. And I think that once people actually can, and just speaking from my own personal experience, once you actually give a field a chance and you learn and you study and somebody takes an interest in you, that makes you more interested in the field and more likely to pursue that field. So mentorship is definitely key for across all demographics, but as you mentioned, particularly we found that in students from underrepresented minority groups.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that in scenarios where we do have a mentor who we feel like we can relate to, you can take it for granted a little bit. It may be par for the course. And I think putting yourself in someone else's shoes, whether it's for gender, socioeconomic, ethnic, whatever issue it is, where they don't feel like they have that person, it really can be challenging. But this was super important, right? Because if we don't understand the problem, then you can't work to fix it. So that's why I really thought it was a nice contribution to our understanding. It's not a topic that we discuss often enough, I think.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was very interesting.
Well, Dr. Scott, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. My last thing, I always ask again, people, especially attendings who staff fellows very frequently, it's graduation time, and graduation time means that there are new fellows coming in, and it's the cycle of education continues. So if you had one piece of advice for fellows who are starting this July, they're starting their 2-year vitreo retinal surgical fellowship, something you wish you had done or something you did that was important, what would be your biggest piece of advice for someone who's just starting fellowship now?
Wow. This is a great time of year, as you mentioned, and the new fellows are there. I would advise all new fellows to work as hard as you can, read as much as you can. You get this unique opportunity in fellowship to train side by side with some great mentors and some great people who have done amazing work in research and in clinical care. And so this is a very unique time to be able to study and learn and really to become experts in the field. I had one of the senior VR surgeons said to me once, he said, well, Tiger Woods practices golf, all the time. And, it's something that even though we think we get to a certain level, we always need to pursue excellence and continue to learn and continue to grow and continue to hone our skills. And when you're in fellowship, you have a very it's a privilege to have this protected time to just learn. So I would advise all first-year fellows and second-year fellows as well to take advantage of the opportunities and the wonderful, experienced minds around you, because, sooner than you know it, you'll be on your own and you'll wish you could go back and see how, somebody peeled a membrane or, how somebody managed a very complex wet AMD case. So, I would say, soak up all the knowledge you possibly can from those around you.
Well, Dr. Scott, thank you so much for the advice, and I'm sure it will be well received and appreciated. And thank you for your time. I know you're very busy, so I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, Dr. Sridhar. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
As always, we can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 118 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback for things we can do better, things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Adrian Scott for joining me. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Minacasa, and Angela Chang for producing this great episode. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Sridhar, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.